from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You want to get a sense of the intensity of feeling about LDS church leader Boyd K. Packer? Go to the comments section in his newspaper obituaries from late last week when he died. You'll find sentiments of admiration, of course, and respect, but you'll also find hate and some real venom. The LDS historian Gregory Prince says it would be easy to make the case that Packer was the most polarizing LDS church official of a generation. He was seen as dogmatic, as unmovable in his resistance to progressive social movements within the church. But Prince says to many faithful Latter-day Saints, Packer was the glue that kept the church together by holding the line on encroaching forces of the outside world. Today in the program, we're talking about Boyd K. Packer, about his influence on the church and the vacuum he's left in the leadership. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. LDS Church Apostle Boyd K. Packer died last Friday in Salt Lake City. He was 90 years old. In a New York Times obit, reporter David Stout wrote that, to judge by his words, Packer was untroubled by doubt and sure of his place in the world. And in fact, Packer was seen as the principal defender of Mormon orthodoxy. He regularly pushed back on social change. His official biography is called A Watchman on the Tower. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack said, the title speaks to Packer's self-perception as a leader whose role was to keep the church pure from outside influences. Today in the program, we're talking about Boyd K. Packer, about his life and his influence on the direction of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We'll also talk about the void that he's left in the LDS leadership. Actually, there are two vacancies to be filled in the hierarchy now, and we'll talk about the implications for all of that as we go along. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gregory Prince is joining us throughout the hour. He's an historian and the author of several books on Mormonism, including an examination of the development of the LDS priesthood and a noted biography of Church President David O. McKay and his influence on what Prince calls the rise of modern Mormonism. And Prince is joining us today from his vacation home in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Gregory Prince, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be back with you.
I guess we should start with something that you've taken note of, and that is, I mentioned this earlier in the introduction, the reaction to the death of Boyd K. Packer, because it seems really striking. I mean, the intensity of the feeling, I guess, on both sides, particularly on those who weren't fond of Boyd K. Packer. What does that say, do you think, about the man?
Well, it certainly says that he was a polarizing personality. I went back and compared the comments on the Salt Tribune article about President Packer's passing with those of Elder Tom Perry's passing, which was only a few weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. And the contrast could hardly be more marked. It was really quite jolting to me to see how acrimonious so many of the comments were.
Is it fair to say some people hated him? Is that not fair, but accurate?
Well, I think if you look at the entries on that comment section in the Tribune, they were quite candid about their hatred. So I think that is fair to say. I'm sorry that that's the case, but it certainly is out there.
Is it fair to call him a bully? Some people said he was a bully.
From the reports that I've heard from a lot of people, I think that is a fair characterization of their experience with him. I didn't have enough personal contact with him to make a judgment on my own.
But others have seen him, have portrayed him that way, that he could be is it mean? The people who've said he was a bully, how are they explaining that? That he was just particular about the way he wanted things?
They say that there was a streak of meanness in him as well. I doubt that that's the way he would have characterized it, but not only reading those comments in the Tribune, but just talking to people over many years, occasionally seeing written reports from them, I got the sense that at least that's the way they interpreted it, and if it had happened to me, I would have interpreted that as meanness.
Yeah. Seems like there's this principal characteristic that those who liked him and those who didn't so much seem to use to describe him, and that is kind of unbending, unyielding. You've said that for Boyd K. Packer, there wasn't really much flexibility in the way he saw the world. So how do you describe that world view of Boyd K. Packer?
Well, I really view him as the conservative. Conservative not just in the sense of wanting to conserve the past, but also really pushing back on moving into the future. He gave an address at the BYU Law School. This was in 2004. And he said, "We may one day stand alone, but we will not change or lower our standards or change our course." And so his whole ministry, I think he locked into a particular way of the church functioning, of people acting out their religion, and he really never varied from that.
Mm. You have what I think is an interesting take on Packer's point of view, because you say he was less concerned over doctrinal issues as he was over behavioral issues. Explain what you mean by that.
He didn't really write a doctrinal treatise. His sermons, on the one hand, could be very pastoral and often eloquent, and didn't really dig down into doctrinal issues. But on the other hand, the way that people lived their religion, the way that the mechanism of church government functioned, seemed to be of overwhelming importance to him. He had a particular worldview, and he was very strident about maintaining that worldview, and very unbending, as you said.
Yeah. So his views on LGBT issues, his views on feminism, on intellectualism within the church, which he saw as encroaching on certain values, and we'll get to all of those as we go. But he didn't see those as theological perspectives. He saw those as matters of behavior.
Well, they certainly had theological ramifications to them.
Sure,
but I think his concern was more: how does that represent a threat to the way we do business as a church? Rather than digging down to some theological underpinning.
One of the things that you often hear, Gregory Prince, is that from critics, we should point out, of Boyd K. Packer, is that he wanted to control the church. Put that in perspective, because you do say, in fact, Boyd K. Packer was skilled at wielding power within the hierarchy.
He was very skilled at it, even before he got into the top position that he occupied for the last 21 years of his life, and we can talk later about the ramifications of that. But even before that, when he joined the Quorum of the Twelve in 1970, so we're talking 45 years ago, almost immediately he began to exert an influence within the corridors of church power that often extended beyond an organizational chart. And that seemed to have been his modus operandi for the rest of his career, that where he saw something that was not in accordance with his worldview, he didn't hesitate to try to fix it, even if it was not in his official portfolio.
Well, one particular story you mention is his attempt at influencing what was going on in the history department, I guess, of the church in general. Maybe this was Brigham Young University. I need you to clarify that. But this was in 1976. That was not, as you say, in his purview, but he went at this issue anyway.
He did. To give a little background on that, in the early 1970s, the entire church bureaucracy really underwent a radical reorganization. What had happened was that in the prior century plus, it had grown from a very small organization to a very large one, and it really was in need of a retooling structurally. And so the church brought in an Eastern consulting firm. They did a top-to-bottom assessment of it and made very strong recommendations, which were implemented, one of which was that they needed to professionalize the historical department. There had never been a church historian who was a professional historian. That changed in 1972, when Leonard Arrington was called as the church historian. Leonard had a doctorate in economics and economic history from the University of North Carolina and was really probably the premier historian of Mormonism of his time. What he brought into the historical department with him was a professionalization of the way that Mormon history was being written, and that became almost an immediate threat to the established order where the ecclesiastical arm had written the history in the past. There were two senior apostles, Ezra Taft Benson and Mark E. Peterson, who took particular offense at that as time moved on. But Boyd Packer, who had only been an apostle for 2 years at the time Leonard was called, also jumped into the fray. 2 years after Leonard went in, he wrote a letter directly to the First Presidency, which was an instance of his going outside of organizational lines because he didn't have the history department in his portfolio. And he said, in part, "What concerns me about the historian's office is that the direction they are taking is to judge what should be good for the church and for the operation of the historical department against the rules set down for historians." And so he really pushed back against the idea that the data should drive the story. To him, the dogma should drive it.
So you mentioned Mark E. Peterson, you mentioned Ezra Taft Benson, both those anyway familiar with the church leadership understand those two as being really conservative in the scheme of things. Did Boyd K. Packer fit into a faction? If not at that time, at any time, was it fair to say that there were segments within the Mormon hierarchy who fit into a kind of more conservative group, others who may have fit into something more progressive? I know Hugh B. Brown is often spoken of as someone more moderate, even liberal, within the hierarchy.
Well, if you can indulge my reference to federal government, since I've lived in Washington, D.C. for the last 40 years, I never saw a Boyd Packer caucus develop. I think he was quite independent in what he thought and what he did. I don't see that he ever really tried to gather around him an inner circle that could act in unison. I think he was such a large presence and was so effective in yielding power that he really didn't need that. He largely was a one-man show and a remarkably effective one-man show for decades.
You found some letters from Packer that kind of illustrate his attempts at lobbying the First Presidency. One I wanted you to talk about, and this was this idea, tacking the idea of theaters at Brigham Young University, a proposal by Ernest Wilkinson. And explain who that is.
Well, it wasn't so much theaters. This was by Ernest Wilkinson, who was the president of Brigham Young University, from about 1951 until the 1970s, and really put BYU on the map nationally as a first-tier university. But one of the things that Wilkinson had envisioned and had worked hard to try to implement was to set up a network of junior colleges, mostly throughout the western part of the United States, because that's where church membership was predominant, and to have those be feeder institutions, with BYU eventually becoming primarily an upper division and graduate university. And he was able to push that far enough that several pieces of land in the West had been purchased with that idea, though there had not been a groundbreaking yet for any of those junior colleges. Boyd Packer wrote a crucial letter directly to the First Presidency that was, I think, the key factor in dismantling that whole program. And it died.
You mentioned that he had kind of a direct line to Brigham Young University. He wasn't crazy about some of the music being taught or performed anyway in the music department down there?
Well, yeah, those are two statements. The first one, a direct line, that was obvious to a lot of people. Initially, it was in his portfolio because for many years he was on the Board of Trustees of BYU. But even after he was released from the Board of Trustees, he maintained a very, very tight contact with influential people down there, either the president of the university at times or the provost, and didn't hesitate to pick up the phone when he felt that a message needed to be sent down there. The second was something that struck closer to home for me because my sister was both an undergraduate and a graduate student in music composition at BYU. And while she was there in the early 1970s, he went down there and gave a speech that just took the air out of the music department, being very critical of what they were doing, of the type of music that they were teaching. And she said it really had a devastating effect for a long time, both on the faculty and on the music students. And music was not it was not his area of expertise.
We're going to get to a break here, and I want to spend some time on his life, what his life tells us about his leadership. But let me ask you this before we do: do you think, on some level, I mean, a lot of people portray him as a bully, they portray him as mean. That's certainly the portrayal. But I'm wondering how much of that do you think Gregory Prince is kind of a myth? Do you think on some level Boyd K. Packer has for some become a caricature on some level, kind of a cartoon figure, sort of the symbolism of what some people may not like about conservative Mormonism?
I think so. I think in his own heart, if I could even venture in that direction, he was totally, totally committed to propping up, strengthening a religion in which he had total belief. I think that his goals probably were always laudable, but his methodology of getting there could be problematic.
One thing you've said is it's unfair to paint him with a broad brush, he shouldn't paint him black, he shouldn't paint him white, that there are many shades of gray. He was a complicated guy, I guess, which is true of all of us, I suppose.
It is true of all of us, but I think you can see, again, going back to the comments that have been posted online in the aftermath of his death, he was so polarizing that on the one end, people very, very critical, venomous even in some of their comments, and on the other side, people who felt that, as you said in the introduction, he really was the glue that was keeping the church together, that he was the steady hand on the controls throughout all of these decades. Both of those have some merit, and they're just in tension with each other.
Mm-hmm. Gregory Prince is with us. He's an historian, author of several books of Mormon history, a remarkable, actually, biography that he wrote about President LDS Church President David O. McKay and his influence on the rise of modern Mormonism. Gregory Prince is joining us from North Carolina. We invite you to join us, too. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about LDS Church Apostle Boyd K. Packer, who died late last week. Packer was beloved among the faithful, perceived by others as doctrinaire and unyielding, outspoken in his condemnation of feminists, of gay people, of intellectuals. We're talking about his life and his influence on the direction of the LDS Church today, and we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We know Boyd K. Packer, obviously, was born in Brigham City, and it seemed like there are a couple of moments in his life that may give us some sense of his worldview. And I'm wondering, and you didn't write a biography of Boyd K. Packer, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but he was confined to his bed at the age of 5 with polio, had to learn to walk again. Do we have any sense of what kind of influence that may have had on Boyd K. Packer's life?
I think it had an influence on both ends of his life. On the front end, if you can imagine, in Brigham City, a very small town in the late 1920s, which is the time period that we're talking about, that suddenly you're stricken with this horrible disease and you lose your ability to walk. that sets you up, I think, for a lot of ridicule from your peers. That just, even when I grew up in the 50s, there was still that kind of peer ridicule at times towards people who had disabilities. It was very mean-spirited, but nonetheless, it could leave deep scars on the back end of his life. Polio came back to haunt him again, and I think people may not realize that he had this double effect from it, because he suffered from what's called post-polio syndrome, that after decades of overuse of the muscles that were rehabilitated for him to be able to relearn how to walk, those muscles essentially wore out, and he was confined to a wheelchair. So on both ends of his life, I'm not a psychologist. I can't get into psychohistory, but yeah. I just think if you were that young and had that devastating a disability and then were able to overcome it, not only might you bear some scars from having experienced that ridicule, but give him credit for him to be able to overcome the effects of polio to the point where he could qualify as a pilot during World War II. Mm. That's really an astounding accomplishment.
Yeah. And that actually leads into the other, it seems anyway, influential time of his life, another one anyway, and that is his experience during World War II, because you've talked about the fact that that seemed to change him, seemed to give him a sense of maybe purpose, a sense of maybe a resolution even.
It seemed to change him markedly, and this comes from someone who described himself as Boyd Packer's closest friend. He was Malcolm Jepson. The two men grew up together in Brigham City. Jepson became a physician, now deceased, but he wrote a very lengthy autobiography, and he spoke in that autobiography of how Packer changed from the time he was growing up to the time that he came back from the war. He said he was an ultra-serious person when he came back. He didn't say, may not even have known, whether there was a single event that had changed him while he was overseas, he was in the Pacific Theater, right, or whether it was just the overall wartime experience, but he seemed to be totally changed by the time he came back, and that seemed to be the demeanor that he carried for the rest of his life.
It's an interesting story you tell of a Mormon leader by the name of Paul H. Dunn. He wasn't an apostle. He was in the general authority, I think, in the Quorum of the 70. And he was a World War II veteran, and he tended to embellish, at least that's how it's believed, his stories from World War II. And as I understand it, Boyd K. Packer didn't think much of that.
No, he was very critical of that. On the other hand, I never heard much detail about his own experiences in the war. He was a bomber pilot, but I don't know that he ever really saw invasive action. In other words, did he go on any sorties in the Pacific? I have the sense that he did not. I knew Paul Dunn very well, particularly in the final years of his life, and read the correspondence that he had sent to his family during the year of 1944 through 45, when he was on the ground as an infantry private in five Pacific campaigns. So if there was embellishment, at least it had a solid background of wartime experience behind it.
That's probably a whole nother show, Paul H. Dunn and his background in the war. But I did find it interesting that you said that Boyd K. Packer found it. If he was, in fact, embellishing, he didn't take kindly to that, I guess.
That's right.
Vet. Yeah. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Stephanie is with us in West Jordan, Utah. Stephanie, hi.
Doug, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My, of course, condolences to his family and those that loved him. I was one of those as a young child. My father was deeply involved with the Quorum of the 70 and the 12 on a religious and doctrinal sense of scripture. And my comment that I wanted to make about President Packer was that even though he was very, very staunch in his opinions and his beliefs, his integrity toward those beliefs was pretty phenomenal, and he always did stick by them. As a child, we used to go over to his house and his property, and he had ducks, and we called them Packers Quackers. And we'd always say, can we go see Packers Quackers? And he was a lover of life and a lover of people. And he may have been, you know, anti-behavior and spoke out strongly against, you know, same-sex, feminism, so on and so forth. But he was, even though he was anti certain things, he was pro people, and he loved people, and he loved animals, and he really was an incredible, gentle, kind, sweet, wonderful man. And though I don't adhere to many of the LDS belief systems now in my adult life, I do recall his influence in my life and the lives of those around him and around me as just a very gentle, sweet, kind, loving man of humanity and of life itself.
Stephanie, we're glad you called. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. We should point out, it's interesting, in her piece in the Salt Lake Tribune, Peggy Fletcher Stack pointed out that most of Packer's sermons were in fact on themes that weren't particularly controversial. That gets a lot of attention, and we'll get back to that as we go. But in her piece, she says most of his sermons were about things like faith and baptism and forgiveness. You want to say anything about that?
Oh, yes. I'd alluded to that earlier, that when he spoke at the pulpit, usually he was speaking on pastoral issues and not hard doctrine. So I agree completely with what you're saying there.
Here's a comment that, well, this is anonymous. This person writes, I think President Packer's push for correlation and conformity destroyed the lifeblood of inspiration, diversity, and community in the church. He was in charge of music for a long period of time. This is a reference to something we were talking about earlier on the program. This person writes, it was he who pushed the hymns-only policy for ward and state choirs, which this person says pushed the great composers of choral literature out of the church for a time on the local level. This person writes, the correlation or budget committees killed the ward activities, the dance festivals, the road shows. There wasn't much life left in the church when I left nearly 10 years ago. Gregory Prince, you want to respond to that?
Hey, yeah, I agree with that. His view of the governance of the church was that it was by edict and not by consensus. It was top down. In fact, on multiple occasions, he would say in a public setting, I am here to teach and not to be taught. The lifeblood of the church in prior decades was the bottom up. I refer to it as trickle up revelation, and it was a very potent force. Most of what the church program was when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s was a result of grassroots initiatives that worked and then were appropriated by the general church. But with the later correlation movement, meaning after the death of President McKay, that effectively was shut off, and it became top-down instead of bottom-up.
There was a speech that Boyd K. Packer gave, rather famously, at least for observers of Mormonism, in May of 1993. Where he identified three enemies of the church. I have this part of this speech in front of me. You have some of it there too. I wondered if you could talk about it and read some sections because it's pretty straightforward.
It is. Let me read two paragraphs from it. There are three areas where members of the church, influenced by social and political unrest, are being caught up and led away. I chose these three because they have made major invasions into the membership of the church. In each, the temptation is for us to turn about and face the wrong way, and it is hard to resist, for doing it seems so reasonable and right. The dangers I speak of come from the gay lesbian movement, the feminist movement, both of which are relatively new, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars or intellectuals. That's the end of the quote.
Now, I should just step in there and say the feminist movement, that got cut off just a bit. The feminist movement was the second.
Yes, the feminist movement. Now, the context of this is quite important. That speech was given on May 18th, 1993. On May 5th, 1993, just 13 days earlier, the Hawaii Supreme Court had issued a ruling on the first serious case advocating for gay marriage in the country. There had been some earlier attempts in other states to raise that issue, and they'd been dismissed early. The case of Bayer versus Lewin in Hawaii went all the way up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. And while the Supreme Court held that the state was justified in denying a license to same-sex couples, it sent the case back down and said because of a provision in the Hawaii state constitution, this case must be reevaluated on the basis of strict scrutiny. That's a legal term which means that the state is allowed to discriminate in certain instances, but if strict scrutiny applies, the burden of proof is on the state to show that there is a compelling state interest justifying the discrimination. And when that happened, it sent a shockwave across the country, including to Salt Lake City. It's what precipitated all of the subsequent state laws, state constitutional amendments, including in Utah, banning gay marriage, because the feeling was that if strict scrutiny were to apply, it was game over, and gay marriage was going to become legalized in Hawaii. And if in Hawaii, then those marriages would have to be honored if those couples moved to other states. So I think you have to view his speech on these three dangers in the immediate context of the legal case that was going on in the state of Hawaii.
Let's talk about October of 2010, because Boyd K. Packer delivers an address in General Conference, LDS General Conference, that received a lot of attention, a lot of controversy, a lot of criticism. I want to play a section from it. Is there any way we need to – is there any thing that we need to say to set this up, do you think, Gregory Prince?
I don't think so. If it's what I think it is, it should be self-explanatory.
We must understand that any persuasion to enter into any relationship that is not in harmony with the principles of the gospel must be wrong. From the Book of Mormon, we learn that wickedness never was happiness. Some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies toward the impure and the unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone? Remember, He is our Father.
Now, that was controversial. Explain why, Gregory Prince, because what he is saying there, as you clearly heard, is that in this sense, sexuality, being of being, you know, LGBTQ, is not preset in the beginning. Now, explain why that was so controversial.
Well, it was controversial not in that this was a new idea,
right,
because this was an idea that long had pervaded Mormon culture and also American culture, that homosexuality was a choice, and that if you could choose to be homosexual, you could then choose not to be homosexual, and so obviously you should make that choice. What was most controversial was the venue in which he gave this at a general conference. It sparked an immediate firestorm of controversy. The Human Rights Campaign, headquartered in Washington, gathered many signatures on a petition and petitioned the church to do something about this. And in fact, they did do something about it very quickly. Almost within hours, the text of that address was changed in a material way, and the passages that had been offensive to the LGBT community were softened, And one other part of it that you didn't play was stricken from the record completely, and that was his attempt from the pulpit to essentially canonize the Proclamation on the Family, to give it the force of revelation, but that one didn't work. That was taken totally out of the official text of his address.
I think that was edited out of the audio, too. I don't think we could find that.
That's interesting. I haven't gone back and re-listened to the audio, but it was there initially.
Yeah.
And it was very striking to those of us who were listening.
The church has done some things that could be perceived as quite progressive related to the gay community. What do we have any sense how what – I mean, this was 2010, this speech of which we're talking. I'm wondering what Boyd K. Packer would have did make of MormonsandGays.org, the website, signing on to various anti-discrimination measures, of course, including this new state law. Do we have any sense of – I'm guessing he may have resisted it, or do you know? I guess we can't know.
We don't know. We have to try to triangulate to that. The MormonsandGays.org website went up without any prior advance notice that I'm aware of. About a year, as I recall, after he gave that speech, and so you wonder, was there some type of a cause and effect relationship there? That website was particularly important and remains particularly important because it was the first time that the church officially said, no, this isn't a choice. The exact wording is, individuals do not choose to have such attractions. Well, that was a 180 from where they had been for decades, where the dogma had been, this is a matter of choice, so choose your way out of it. Now that got flipped completely on its head. I don't know how much buy-in would have been required for him for that website to be posted. He, after all, was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, and those things you would think don't happen without buy-in from the Quorum, and the Quorum acts on the basis of consensus. The same thing earlier this year, with Senate Bill 296 in Utah, which was the LGBT non-discrimination law that was really groundbreaking, not just for the state of Utah, but I think nationally, where you had senior apostles, most notably Tom Perry,
right,
getting out in front and saying in unambiguous language, the church supports this law. That would have been, I think, a difficult pill for him to swallow in his earlier years. I don't know if he changed or if at that point his health had declined to where he just wasn't in the loop anymore. We're left guessing on that.
Right. Let me read an email from Gary as we head into another break. He writes, the whole purpose of the LDS gospel as opposed to theology is the modification of behavior, the making of good men from bad and better men from good. It's not surprising, Gary writes, as to who is and who was most offended by Elder Packer. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gregory Prince is with us, joining us from North Carolina, where he's on vacation. He's been kind enough to join us this morning. And we'll take another quick break. Be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the influence of LDS Church Apostle Boyd K. Packer, who died late last week. Historian Gregory Prince is joining us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Twitter or on Facebook. This comment came from Michael on our Facebook page. He writes, you can justify and excuse him as much as you like, but Elder Packer is responsible for many suicides, suicidal thoughts, and he destroyed families in his harmful and hateful words spoken to the world through conferences. It gives you another sense, Gregory Prince. I guess what we were talking about earlier, he tends to provoke a lot of strong feeling to this idea that he may have prompted people to feel unworthy, even suicidal, that the strength of his particular positions could be unyielding. Anything to say about that?
I think there's a lot of merit to that statement. I am a straight ally on the National Board of Directors of Affirmation, which is an LDS LGBT support group independent of the church, but populated largely by gays who want to have an engagement with the church. And the sense that I get from speaking to many, many gays and lesbians in the church, including my own sister, is that his words and those of other church authorities and some church policies have been very destructive to that community. And the anecdotal reports that I get are that there have been suicides that have been directly linked to those words. Talking to one person, one of the community organizations in Utah, she said that when there has been a general conference where that theme has been struck strongly, she said there will be a blip of suicides throughout the state shortly after that. And I think that's very unfortunate and unnecessary.
Let's talk about his what some perceived anyway as Boyd K. Packer's crusade against this bent of intellectualism within Mormonism. Packer himself was conservative. It's interesting to note that he ran for city council in Brigham City as a Democrat, but I'm guessing that was probably another iteration of the party, unfamiliar to the one that possibly is there today. Can we say he was politically fairly conservative? I mean, it is interesting that he was in the mission field as an LDS mission president in the 1960s, in fact, during the Vietnam War.
I never saw or heard of him engaging in partisan politics, so I really have nothing to say about his partisan affiliation. But you're right, he was called to be the president of the New England States Mission in 1965 and served for 3 years. The mission home at that time was just a stone's throw, literally, from Harvard Square. And so he became immersed in the Vietnam War culture. And from the accounts that I've heard of graduate students who were there at the time, whether at Harvard or Tufts or the other Boston-based universities, it really seemed to be the influence that turned him against intellectuals.
You often hear talk of a so-called purge in the 1990s, where several academics, scholars were excommunicated. What was Boyd K. Packer's influence in that experience? Do we have any way of knowing?
Sure, we do, because it was made public through Steve Benson, who is a grandson of Ezra Taft Benson, who at the time was the president of the church, though he was incapacitated at the time, and that became part of the story. The official church line was that these disciplinary councils are local matters. But one of the other members of the Quorum of the Twelve told Steve that, in fact, President Packer had made phone calls to stake presidents initiating some of these disciplinary councils. And Steve went public with it, and there was a walking back of that original statement by the people in Salt Lake. So, yes, he was, in that instance at least, intimately involved in disciplinary councils that cost some intellectuals their church membership.
Let's talk for a moment about his views on feminism, which he identified as that third enemy of the church back in 1993. What do we know about his – I mean, clearly he had a sort of basic traditional view of men and their role in Mormonism and the patriarchy, I suppose.
He did. He certainly had a large family, had 10 children. His wife was a stay-at-home wife throughout her lifetime, and so he practiced what he preached, but he seems to have been increasingly threatened by the rising tide of feminism. Just to give a little bit of historical context, what is considered the beginning of the modern feminist movement was the publication in 1963 of the book The Feminine Mystique. 2 years later, the National Organization for Women was founded. In 1972, the Equal Rights Amendment was passed by the U.S. Congress and then sent to the states for ratification. And we know the history there of how the LDS Church jumped in and eventually became the decisive factor in defeating that amendment. So this was something that was very much on his mind, and he really did not want to see the status quo change in terms either of women being ordained or even of having them become more of a voice within the church than they were at the time. He wanted that status quo to remain unchanged. I was speaking with one woman in Los Angeles when I was working on the McKay book, and she said in her stake there was a priesthood meeting where President Packer was going to be the speaker. They had several deaf priesthood members in their stake, and so the stake president called upon a woman who was an interpreter with American Sign Language to be there to provide interpretation for these gentlemen. She gave up a paying gig in order to be there, and when she got there, he said, "No, you can't be in on this meeting. You're a woman."
Wow.
Yes. And afterwards, the woman that I was interviewing said, she called some of the men who were there and said, "So what went on in that meeting that was so secretive?" And they said, "Nothing. It was just a typical priesthood meeting." I think that is, that seems to be typical of the degree to which the threat of feminism reached into his soul.
Let's shift, since we're running out of time, to what may be next. That is, you know, who may fill these posts. There are two vacancies, as we mentioned. Obviously impossible to speculate about something like this, but it seems like Gregory Prince, for some observers, the makeup of the Mormon hierarchy is something like the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, you have people speculating about their ideology and where they might fit along some sort of, you know, continuum, whether they're moderates or whether they're, you know, doctrinaire and conservative. Is that a proper read on the way it works? And what are you expecting next?
I think your analogy to the Supreme Court is a very good one, because you have, in essence, a Supreme Court of 15 men, the first presidency and the Quorum of the 12, who really are in judgment over the affairs of the church, and they do it for life. So there's the connection to the U.S. Supreme Court. A difference is that when a Supreme Court justice is confirmed, you think you know what you're getting, but sometimes there are surprises. In the current court, Anthony Kennedy has been the most decisive vote for many years. Where he is deciding these issues now is not where most people would have thought he would decide when he went into the court. The difference in the LDS Church is, not to stretch the point too thinly, but you could say that the vetting process begins in primary. That these men have been so thoroughly
explain
what, vetted.
Explain, Gregory, explain what primary is for the
primary is the organization for the children.
Yeah.
And almost from the time of that age, these men are evaluated, they're vetted as they move up through the ranks, so that by the time they are called to be general authorities, there really aren't any surprises left. So what you get going in tends to be what you get for the remainder of their life, and in that sense, it's unlike the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, who will be chosen and what ideological, what ethnic constituency they might represent remains to be seen.
Right.
I'll speak on my own behalf and not on behalf of anybody else or of the church. I would love to see greater representation from the primary constituency in the church now, and that is the Spanish-speaking constituency, which is over half the church membership. So a Hispanic apostle, I think, would be a marvelous thing to have. There's something else, since we're talking about Boyd Packer in particular, that came to mind as I was thinking about this today. I look at the Roman Catholic Church, and I look at the most recent two popes. Nobody would question the devotion of Pope Benedict to the Roman Catholic Church. And I have never questioned the devotion of Boyd Packer to the Mormon Church. But I see a strong parallel between those two men. very doctrinaire, very concerned with preserving what they felt to be the purity of the church organization. I would love to see the LDS equivalent of a Pope Francis, a man who, in a very short period of time, has transformed Roman Catholicism throughout the world.
We've talked on this program, you joined us, in fact, about President Monson's health. The church says he prefers to keep that a private matter, so we won't say much about that. What kind of leadership do you think he's going to provide at this moment about who will step into these roles, two vacancies, as I mentioned, and others who are ailing, so there could be others in the coming years?
The manner by which new apostles are chosen has never really been set out in any detail by the church hierarchy, but as I've spent years going through the historical record, including the diaries of President McKay, there is some variability according to the church president at the time. One president may already have his mind made up and really doesn't ask for the counsel of the apostles or even necessarily his counselors in the first presidency, where another president may solicit recommendations from all of the members of the Quorum of the Twelve. In the case of President McKay, I know in one instance he asked for three names from each member. And the reason I knew that is that my co-author Bob Wright was the nephew of President McKay's secretary, Claire Middlemas. And she told him that she walked into his office one day and saw him standing over his desk putting slips of paper in piles, almost as if he were dealing out cards, to see where the sentiment of the quorum was as to who the new apostle should be. Now, it turned out that the man who received the majority of the votes was not the man that he called. But it's going to be different mechanism for different presidents, and I have no idea if President Monson will lean on his counselors and or the Quorum of the Twelve for input.
Historian Gregory Prince, author of several books, including David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, joined us today from his vacation home in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Gregory Prince, thank you again for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Doug. Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News, technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Mombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.